The Beauty Queen of Lanann is one of those shows that is really special. The reason I go to the theatre is for those magical experiences where you're taken out of yourself, you see something that's brilliant, it takes your breath away, it makes shivers go down your spine, you laugh, you cry, you get told a good story, you learn more about life. The Beauty Queen of Lanann does all of that, and dare I suggest it even more. Lucky enough today to be with Joe Hill-Gibbons, its director at the Young Vic. Joe, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
I'd like to know, first of all, you were probably at school or university when the play was originally produced.
Yeah.
Did you see Gary Hines' Druid production?
Yeah, I did. I did. I saw it a couple of times, and I remember it very well. I was, I didn't live in London at the time, but I was very obsessed by the Royal Court. Well, in a way, I still am. You know, it's fantastic theatre. But that was back in sort of, when was it on? 95, 96. So that was when Stephen Daldry was running the theatre, and there were so many fantastic plays coming out of there. Things like The Weir and Mojo and Blasted and Shopping and Fucking and Martin's plays. So I remember being in London and thinking, well, I should go and see what's on at the Royal Court. So I love the Royal Court. And reading this, the play to see was this thing called The Beauty Queen of Lanann. And I was thinking, it's an Irish play called The Beauty Queen of Lanann. I don't know what that is. It sounds a bit like a sort of Maeve Binchy novel or something. I'm not going to like this. And it's about a relationship between a mother and a daughter. And I thought, well, this is not going to be for me, really. I don't. I'm not going to get this. But of course, I went to see it and just thought, well, this is incredible. You know. Because it has that quality, doesn't it, that Martin McDonagh's writing within a particular kind of form and world, but completely subverting it as well. So although in some respects it's this little domestic melodrama about a mother and a daughter, it's also got this fantastic, the wicked black sense of humour, and it's a very sort of postmodern touches as well, where they're talking about Australian television programmes on the TV and things. So actually it was much more accessible and entertaining and up my street than I ever thought it might be. And then I saw it again, actually. I saw it when they did the trilogy.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to see that on a Saturday, where you saw, you know, Beauty Queen at, I don't know, about 2 o'clock or something, 2:30, and then The Skull in Connemara, and then The Lonesome West in the evening. And just a fantastic day. I mean, heaven, really. So I'd always loved the plays. I mean, particularly Beauty Queen and Lonesome West, I think, are my favourite of Martin's plays. He's written many brilliant ones, but they were always my favourite. And so I'd known them for a long time, but hadn't really thought about doing them. It's funny, you know, picking when is the right time to revive a play. And I was looking for something to do here, and it was actually David Land's idea. He said, what about The Beauty Queen of Lanann? And so immediately I said, well, yeah, if we can get the rights to it, let's do it, because it's fabulous. But I suppose, you know, it was such a big hit last time, you know, from a sort of producing point of view, you're always judging when's the best time to bring it back. And actually, I think we judged it right 13 years afterwards.
It's quite difficult as well, because, like you, I saw the original production, I saw the trilogy. There was actually a production at Watford Palace I saw maybe 3 years ago as well. So it has been back almost to London, but not quite.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still have vivid memories of, I've forgotten her name, Anna Manahan, who was just incredible, and Marie Mullen, and just the whole cast. And therefore, it is brave. It's not like putting on a play that people haven't seen for a generation or more. It's still very memorable.
Yeah.
You weren't overawed by that, or you were, but you went anyway?
I suppose, if I'm honest, but I suppose I couldn't really admit it to myself at the time, I suppose I was a bit nervous about that. It's weird, you know, I've done, actually most of the stuff I've done has been new plays.
Yeah.
And so there, you know, when you're, when a play's never been put on before, I mean, of course, you only do the work that, the plays that you, you know, completely believe in, but I suppose if there is an underlying subconscious fear from the writer and the actors and you as the director, is the fear is it any good? You know, of course, as I say, you only pick the scripts you want to do. You believe in it, but on some level, you're thinking, on the fundamental level, does this work? What will the audience think? Whereas this was different with this one, because what you know about it and is that it's a fantastic play and it definitely works. So if I screwed it up, The only explanation could be the production wasn't good. So I think, I suppose, you know, of course, I never really tried to think about that explicitly. You never talk about it with the actors, but I suppose we all felt that, you know, we all knew that that terrific production before. But, you know, as brilliant as that production was, I feel that we've, you know, managed to do something which is can stand alongside it in some way, I hope.
The key to that must be in the casting, and you managed to get Rosaline Linehan, which is an incredibly difficult name to say, but I got it.
Yeah.
And Susan Lynch, which is an easy name to say.
Yeah.
And they live with it, they do compare.
Yeah.
How hard was it to cast?
Well, in some respects, it's not. In some respects, it's not that hard. You just have to get lucky with a play like this. I mean, take for example, Rosaline's part. So you know, it's a very unusual character in the sense it's a leading part in a play, and it's a 70-year-old woman. And also, of course, you want you know, Martin was specific about this as well. You know, you've got to get Irish actors. You know, I mean, that's essential, especially for me being an English director. There was no way I even thought about casting somebody who wasn't Irish. So suddenly, you know, take the example of Rosaline's character. Well, you've got to find someone who's 70 or thereabouts. You need to find someone who's Irish, and you need to find someone who's a leading actor. You know, who can really, really do it, really play one of the big parts. And that, there's not many people like that around, and there's only one, Rosaline Linehan. So in that sense, it wasn't difficult. You draw up a list, which is a short list anyway, and you go, well, let's get Rosaline Linehan. She's top of the list. So then it was just a question of whether she would say yes, and fortunately she did. I mean, I think her agent told me that not long before we got in touch with her, she'd actually said to her agent she'd like to play the part. Because I suppose that's, you know, as much as I was thinking, God, I really hope Rosaline says yes, it cuts the other way in the sense that I suppose from Rosaline's point of view, it's a fantastic part. For her to play, so she was thrilled when it came up, and that was great. Yeah. And then with Susan, I mean, it's you know, she's just a fantastic actor, you know. So in that sense, it wasn't difficult. In with this kind of casting, this kind of show, it only gets difficult if people say no, and then you have to think, okay, well, how do we think about this differently? But when you've got an idea about who you want and you go for them and you say yes, it's great, you know, and as you said, it's so important for the show. Yeah.
For those that don't know the play, do you want to tell us a little bit more about it without giving away too much of the excitement?
Yeah, sure. It's set in so it's The Beauty Queen of Leenane, and Leenane is a real place in Ireland. It's a very small, incredibly beautiful little village on the west coast of Ireland, and so in Galway, in Connemara. And the play is so it's in quite a relatively remote part of Ireland, and then within Leenane it's set in a little cottage which is even more remote, on top of a mountain in Leenane, and trapped in the kitchen living room of this cottage are two women, an elderly woman, a 70-year-old, and her 40-year-old daughter. And they're kind of locked in this sort of terrible, you know, you couldn't really describe it as a love-hate relationship. It's more of a hate-hate relationship. Mother is really dependent on the daughter and very possessive of her, doesn't want the daughter to have her own life, and the daughter is very resentful that she has to look after the mother, and she's trapped with the mother, and they have this very intense relationship, but it's also, there's this very kind of complex, strange kind of codependency thing going on. It makes me think about, you know, sometimes when you see an old married couple who just argue all the time, and you think, well, what? I don't understand why they're together, but there's something strange going on about why they need each other. And so you've got this mother and daughter, you know, trapped together in this house, and then a message comes. A message is delivered, inviting the daughter to a going away do, at which there will be other people there and men there, and sort of a chance of for her to have a night out, which is a big event in her life. She doesn't have much of a social life, and this invite just escalates the conflict between the mother and the daughter, and is the sort of catalyst for the play. But as you say, you know, like as you say, in terms of not giving much away, one of the great things about the play is that's only the start, and there's so many twists and turns in it. I mean, it's one of the key sort of features of the play. And kind of insane, really. I mean, you know, Martin McDonagh wrote this play, you know, when he was sort of 23, 24. And, you know, he swears it's true that he wrote it in 8 days and barely rewrote it. And what sets it out from so many plays is that the storytelling, and more specifically the plotting, is just magnificent, you know. And it's what one of the things that makes it really powerful in front of an audience is that, you know, his ability to set up certain things in the writing which pay off later. So there's lots of twists and turns and reversals and surprises which as much as they hopefully, you know, when it really works to thrill an audience because you don't see what's coming, that it's actually meticulously set up and constructed. So it's a brilliant, I mean, it's a sort of masterclass in how to write.
The thing that amazes me about it is I'm sort of as familiar with it as some Shakespeare plays. Yeah. I've seen it so often, and yet you can sit there and get so much from it, knowing what's coming next the whole time. And most plays, you know what's coming next, that's the end, there's no point in going.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that I always felt going into this, into the play, and I hope people feel when they see it, is that there's a really, within that storytelling and the twists and turns, there's something brutal about it. There's sort of, I'm not giving too much away, but there's some sort of gory moments or shocking moments. So there's a thing about a certain pleasure in the play about plot twists and sort of macabre things happening. But there's another side to the play, which, as much as it's a sort of brilliant kind of mechanical construction of all these twists and turns, I think it's got a real heart to it. You know, I think it's got a real, I think there's real depth and complexity in the characterization. So as much as, of course, one of my focuses was in directing was just deliver the story, it was also trying to make it as psychologically and emotionally complex and rich as I could. I mean, particularly the character of Maureen.
That's the daughter.
It's the daughter, yeah, exactly, the 40-year-old daughter. It's sort of, again, it's a mystery. Well, it's not a mystery, I suppose. It's just talent how Martin McDonagh wrote that when he was, so, you know, it's a 24-year-old guy writing about a 40-year-old woman. But I think it's genuinely, I'm sure if it's not already, I hope as time goes by, it's considered one of the great part in British and Irish writing of the last 25 years for a 40-year-old woman. The layers of complexity in it are fabulous, you know, and so we were trying to explore that as well.
The other thing that worked very well for me was the staging. I was trying to work out how to describe it. It's sort of maybe a semi-thrust into a kind of an L shape, but the stage is at an angle and it really draws you in. And there were times, and my guest said exactly the same, where you really wanted to jump up on the stage. You felt so involved with it and stop these people doing what they were doing to each other.
Yeah, I know. I'm really pleased you say that, because for quite a long time, Alts, the designer, and I were sort of wrestling with it, because I mean, when we started off thinking about the design, I mean, Alts and I don't know Ireland very well, so we came with it from a slightly sort of shy point of view of thinking, okay, we're doing this play, we don't know anything about it, it's ostensibly naturalistic, so you need to have a lot of really sensual naturalistic detail, we've got to find out about this. So we went on a research trip, and we went to Linan, and we stayed in Linan, and we also went to a place called Westport and a place called Carrow, which I mentioned in the play. And we went around Linan in, a time-honoured tradition of people, directors and designers from all over the world, because the play's produced all over the world, who turn up there, you know, sort of Danes and Ukrainians, and say, we're doing Martin McDonagh's The Beauty Queen of Linan. And we, you know, got into conversations with local people, and you know, we said that we want to look inside these kinds of houses. And people were very kind, you know, they would say, oh, yes, well, there's a family down the road called the Coins, you know, I can get you in there. And so we managed to get inside these particular kind of turn-of-the-century cottages that we wanted to look at, and photograph everything in a very nerdy way. we'd measure the width of the fireplace, and actually so much of what, if you come and see the show, what's in the set, you know, things like the colours of the doors, the proportions, the ceiling, so much of it is just detail we took from Linan. So we got that. We got the sense of what the room wanted to be. But then one of the challenges is the play is very, it's a sort of very devoutly proscenium arch play. I mean, it's based on quite a sort of traditional, old-fashioned form or model of theatre, which Martin McDonagh both totally embraces and also subverts as well. And so there's just things about when you read the play, you know, you get a sense of where the doors are, how the entrances and exits work, how the scene changes work. I mean, they're obviously supposed to have a complete blackout or a curtain coming in and you change the scene. And the more you think about it, well, this is really like an end-on proscenium arch play, especially as well because you've got an old woman, the 70-year-old mother, who sits in a rocking chair for most of the play. So of course Alt and I went, well, can you do this in the round? Can you? And not really, because you've got this woman sat in a chair, well, you know, the whole time. So actually then we thought we'd done the hard bit because we'd got all the detail, and then actually it took us ages to work out how to do it in the Young Vic, because the Young Vic, if people know it, is in a funny way, it's got the quality of a really big studio theatre, in the sense there's not a fixed stage. So every time you make a show in there, you have to decide where we're going to put the stage and where we're going to put the audience. You've got so many choices, but it's not like there's a ready-made proscenium arch, and in a way it's sort of like an octagon, so it's kind of plays best in the round or thrust, which we couldn't really do with it. So we spend a long time cutting up bits of card and modelling up different things, and we've ended up with, rather than, you know, people sort of call it sometimes, don't they, fourth wall naturalism with a proscenium arch, as if the, you know, one wall is taken off the house and that's the audience, the wall the audience looked through. We've kind of taken off two walls from the house, so you're kind of looking in it from two points of view. But you know what's great about it is when the audience are watching it. Unlike a proscenium arch theatre where you're all facing in the same direction, completely in the dark, the audience are a little more aware of each other. It's a quality the Young Vic space has, and I think that means that when there are a few twists and turns, and sometimes, you know, the audience sometimes I think feel more licensed to interact, you know, gasp or say something, and that's no bad thing, actually.
Change the subject completely. Go back to the start of your career. You won James Mingus Kitchen Award, so you were the best young director of your year, if you like. Mm. And the play that you chose to celebrate the event was put on at BAC, and it was A Thought in Three Parts by Wallace Shawn, which I have to say, until I saw the production, I didn't think was actually could be put on the stage for various reasons.
Yeah.
I suppose the first question I'd ask is, did you intend to set out to shock people? Did you think, I've won this award, I really want to make people notice me?
No, actually, no. I mean, it sounds quite clever. It's quite a good way of marketing myself as a director. But actually, it wasn't that. I mean, I've always found it quite hard to find stuff I want to direct, and which is partly, there's not a lot of good work out there, but it's partly always hard to sort of commit to things. You always say, well, I don't know whether I could do this, or, you know, out of fear probably more than anything else. But A Thought in Three Parts is a play that I just adore. I mean, perhaps shouldn't say this because it's quite but it feels like, on some strange way, it's completely the story of my life, in a way. Not in a very literal way. It's, for people who don't know it, it's a play. It's a play about sex, and I suppose it's a play about, but it's also about sex and loneliness. So it's a thought in three parts. It's in three different sections, and they're completely different with completely different characters. So it's almost like you know, three different short plays in themselves. And they're both all three parts of it are sort of about the difficulties of you know, people connecting both physically and emotionally. And I love this play. I totally love this play. And with the sort of naivety of youth, thought, well, I'll just do it, because the second play, which is called The Youth Hostel, the second part of it, has a lot of, as you know, incredible amount of nudity. And not just nudity, it's in a very sexual context. You know, the first part, which I think is called Summer Evening, is about a very sort of buttoned up, very sort of bourgeois couple in a hotel room together, trying to, I suppose, you know, the fact that the kind of their sexuality is really, really under the surface. They're kind of struggling to deal with it and being very sort of polite and awkward. and through the scene find their way to being on the bed together. So it's all about the sort of repressed sexuality and how they can't say how they really feel. And the second part, the youth hostel, which is the most sort of infamous part, is kind of the opposite. It's kind of people just walk into a room and and they sort of say, hey Bob, hi Judy, how are you, do you fancy having sex, yeah let's have sex, and they have sex and they go, oh, weirdly that's kind of feels not, I don't know, that didn't, I didn't really enjoy that, I don't know, well, let's go and have sex with someone else, and it's just this endless sort of couplings, and yeah, I suppose if I'd been a bit older, or if I, you know, I thought, well, I can't really do that, it's really difficult, but I there was a certain maybe naivety, but I just kind of thought, oh, this is the best play I think I've read. I just want to do this play, and I wasn't originally going to do it with the actors nude. And then I met Max Stafford Clark, who did the original production, and Max had done it where there'd been a lot of nudity in it, and it was quite controversial at the time. I think there was a question asked about it in the House of Commons, I think, when Max did it in 77, I think it was. And after talking to Max about it, I sort of thought, well, I can't. After hearing that, I can't now, whatever it was, sort of 20 years later, go, oh, well, we'll do it and they'll all be in sort of body stockings or something. It would feel somehow not quite taking up the challenge. So we ended up doing it with all the nudity in. And I still, actually, I've moved house recently, but for a long time I had, for years afterwards, I had stuck on my bedroom door a sign that appeared after the first preview at the Battersea Arts Centre, and it said something like, a thought in three parts, so the Battersea Arts Centre logo on it said, a thought in three parts contains scenes of a sexual nature, graphic scenes of a sexual nature or something, and it says, if for whatever reason you would like your ticket refunded or you'd like to see something else, please speak to the box office. And I stuck that on my bedroom door because I always thought, God, I hope as I get older I can still do something that feels as kind of naughty or edgy, or, you know.
I don't know about naughty. You've certainly done something equally edgy this time around, which is tremendous. Most of your work has been Royal Court, Young Vic, probably, and you're, I get the title, is it assistant director at the Young Vic now?
Yeah, I'm deputy artistic director.
I apologise. Deputy artistic director. Yeah. Wonderful title. What have you got lined up next?
The next thing I'm working on is, this is sort of a treat for me this year, going from Beauty Queen to the Glass Menagerie, Tennessee Williams play. So start rehearsing that in about 9 weeks, but you know, hey, who's counting? But just getting my head out of Lunan and getting my head over to St. Louis in America. And it's just a treat to do another fantastic play. You know, it's funny, there's some links between Beauty Queen and Glass Menagerie. You know, they both have these slightly dysfunctional, interesting mother-daughter relationships, and also the kind of the theme in both of them is you can't escape your family. I mean, that's what Maureen at the end of Beauty Queen is dealing with, but also Tom in the Glass Menagerie, who's run away from his mother and his daughter, but they are still in his head, and that's, you know, I think that's a level on which everyone can connect with these plays, isn't it? You know, your family, make you who you are, and as much as you, whether you want to or not, you can't ever completely escape them.
I can't imagine that it's going to be possible to get tickets for Beauty Queen still, but I might be surprised. The Glass Menagerie, I'm sure tickets will be still available. Joe Hill-Gibbons, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.